All right, Chase just gave me the signal that we're go ahead on the live stream. So we're gonna go ahead and let Steph get started, and we'll let people trickle in as they come down from the late service and everything else. But it's good to see everyone here today. I know some of our regular Sunday morning classes are joining us across the course of these 2 months. Some of our classes are joining us for 1 month or the other month. And then I know also we probably have people in here that don't normally go to a Sunday morning class, but may be here to check out what Steph has to say. So whatever brings you here today, we welcome you. Also, if you're joining us from online, I want to say that this is the very first time we've tried to live stream something for McWhorter. So if the experience is a little strange or a little funky, forgive us. We'll continue to mess with it. We're still figuring out technology 2 years later. We figured out how to do a lot of things really well in the theater now, but we wanted to figure out how to do this in McWhorter as well, because McWhorter gives a space for those that are gathered to have discussion around tables, and Steph's hoping to spark some discussion as well towards the end of each presentation. Although she told me that after she got preparing on this one, she said, I've got a lot to say this first day. So we'll see how much time we've got to do discussion at the end of our time together today. Also, if you're with us online, I'm going to go on to the live stream in a minute and put a link to a Zoom. And after she's done with her presentation, if there is time for discussion, if those of you that are with us online would like to be part of the discussion, you can follow that Zoom link, and I will make sure that we have a conversation going online as well over some of the things that Steph's going to invite us to talk about. But without further ado, I'm going to let Steph kind of introduce herself. But Steph Fulbright is actually a member at West End. She also has a degree from Vanderbilt University from the Divinity School, and I'll let her tell you whatever she wants to tell you about herself and what she's going to teach us about. So I turn it over to Steph. Okay, there you go.
Wonderful. Thank you. This is, I don't usually have microphones, so this is going to be an interesting experience. Well, thank you all for coming. This is from Camp Meetings, City Halls, Christianity in the 19th century. So we'll be spending some time with the historical church today. So a little bit about myself. I know I've met some of you, know some of you. But I've been in Nashville for almost 14 years, 14 years in August, originally from the Boston area. Came down to go to Belmont, where I did my undergrad in history and business, and then ultimately did my master's in public history and religion at Vanderbilt. Brandon didn't tell you we were classmates. So I am a generalist when it comes to history, which means I do a long span of time. I like to joke and do everything from 300 to about 1950. So that is a long time. So when we do get to the question point, and I'll stay after if folks have questions, if I don't know the answer to your question off the top of my head, I will try to get an answer for you next week.
If you turn that mic so you can speak directly in the middle.
Good tips.
You're welcome,
help.
You just keep talking. I'll get it.
Great. Is this better?
Yeah, I'll get it.
Okay. Hey, so some other just fun things about me. I'm a tea enthusiast for the fall. I'm also a dog mom to a 3.5-year-old Great Dane, which if you've ever been on a Zoom with me, you've probably seen her show up. She's also has to listen to all the first drafts of my lectures, so you can thank her for that. And then I'm also a podcaster for a church history podcast called Church Historia. We are launching our second season this month, so I'm really excited about that as well. And then I also work in IT in case I needed something else to do. So this is our quick agenda for the next 4 weeks. These will all be standalone lectures, so if you can't come for a week, that's totally fine. We'd love to see you again the next week. And we're going to be moving our way through the 19th century. So this first week, we're going to look at religion in the early republic, so that first quarter of the 19th century. Next week, we're going to talk about different humanist movements, different millennialist movements that are focused on the end of times, Christian perfection. How do we have assurance of our faith and our salvation? And so that'll be kind of the middle, or the first part of the middle of the 19th century. In our third week, we're going to talk about the Civil War. There's a lot that one can talk about the Civil War. So we're going to particularly focus on how the Civil War changes the way that we think about religion and different sort of topics that fit under that umbrella. And then finally, in the fourth week, we're going to round out the end of the 19th century by looking at Christian advocacy and how Christians participate in movements like temperance and women's suffrage and social reform. So that's a pretty linear way through history, but history itself is often not linear. And so in order to understand a specific moment, we have to go a little bit broader. And I love this quote from Sam Weinberg, who's a professor of historical pedagogy or how to teach history. And he says that contexts are neither found nor located, and words are not put into context. Context means to weave together, to engage in an active process of connecting things in a pattern. So I tell you this as a warning to say, I'm going to talk about a whole lot more than those four chunks that I just mentioned. And in light of that, we're going to actually start in the 17th and 18th centuries today, and we will get to the 19th century. But as we think about talking about the early republic in the United States, we need to look at the founding of the United States and how we got to where we were. So religion in the American colonies has this tension in it. In some ways, it's fairly uniform. Most of the United States is Protestant. It's Puritan or Congregationalist, Presbyterian, Methodist, and Baptist overwhelmingly, with a little bit of Anglican expression as well. And so what this means is that most people participating, particularly in political discourse in the American colonies and the American Revolution, share some core fundamental beliefs and understandings about how the world works. Some things are givens for them. But we would be overstating things if we left it there. There's actually also a lot of diversity in the colonial period and in the time of the revolution. So we have the spiritualities and religions of the indigenous peoples of North America, which in and of themselves are very diverse and varied. Sometimes we group them together, but there's a lot of richness and variety there. We have Catholics, both in the United States, particularly in Maryland, but then also surrounding the American colonies in French Canada and the French exploration of the West, in the Spanish colonization of South America, Central America, and also some of the Western part of what becomes the United States, as well as Florida. There are some Jewish communities in the United States at this time as well. And then there's the traditional African spiritualities and religions brought over by enslaved Africans and transatlantic slave trade. So while we'll primarily be talking about Protestant traditions and generally even low church Protestant traditions, it's important to understand that this is not the exclusive religious expression in the United States. So one of the things that I primarily want to talk about is the First Great Awakening, because we're also going to look at the Second Great Awakening. So the church throughout its history goes through these cycles of stabilization, where the church settles into its traditions, into its norms. But then after a period of time, maybe it starts to get a little bit lax with those traditions, or people start to feel like it's fallen away from its main purpose and main calling. And so then we start to see a rise of these calls for revival, for renewal, for reform, for a calling back to purity of purpose, the purity of whatever rituals or norms that we have. And then there'll be a reform movement. That reform movement becomes the new stabilized traditional form. And then it goes through a period of its own revival and reform. So we see this kind of wave or cycle happen time and time again. And so this is one of them. And there is a lot of dialogue between England and the United States during this time. And we're going to primarily be focusing on the American manifestation of this Great Awakening. And so what is going on with this Great Awakening? What is happening is there's a series of waves of evocative, emotional preaching that are calling people to be born again, to have these direct, immediate encounters with God in a way that changes their lives. And Drs. James Byrd and James Hednut Boimler, who are over at the Divinity School at Vanderbilt, recently wrote a book called The Survey of Religion in America, which is a really great overarching history of religion in America if you're looking for a book. Not sponsored. They were my advisors, but not sponsored. And so they summarized the First Great Awakening really well. And they say, with all of its diversity and controversy, the Great Awakening gave rise to evangelicalism, Protestant movement stressing that all people were sinners and needed to undergo the new birth, a conversion experience which radically altered the direction of one's life. And so this idea of being born again, of having this immediate encounter with God, is one that we're going to see again and again. There's a lot of things that we could talk about this movement, but I want to highlight two main figures. The first is George Whitefield. I'm seeing some nods about Whitefield. So he's a figure that some of you may be familiar with, but he lived from 1714 to 1770, and he encountered John Wesley in the Holy Club in Oxford and became an Anglican priest. And for our purposes, what's really important about Whitefield is how Whitefield went about preaching. At this time, preaching was done in a church. You had to be invited to come and deliver a sermon. There were a lot of concerns about things being orderly and decent, and that worship was done in this way because that was the best way to honor God. But Whitefield felt like the good news was too good and too important to be shared to wait for somebody to invite him to the church. He felt like his parish was the one. And so he started doing this radical, new, very controversial thing, preaching outdoors. And Whitefield had a background as an actor, and so that gave his preaching a distinct style. He was really loud, which was great, and lots of people could hear him. Some estimates are he could speak up to crowds of 30,000. I have a nice microphone for this crowd here. Thank you very much. Can't imagine trying to make 30,000 people try to hear me. That's some impressive skills there. Also, he preached in common language. He used simple terms. He wasn't trying to be overly formal in his preaching. And unlike many of his contemporaries, he memorized his sermons so that he wasn't reading from them. And so all of this made Whitefield a dynamic speaker that drew people in. And he began to have tremendous success as a preacher, as a revivalist, people coming to hear him and being impacted by what he had to say. Some scholars estimate that he preached over 18,000 sermons to a total of probably about 10 million people. So a tremendous, tremendous impact. And as he began to do this, became popular in England, Wesley had some things to say. I like to think about Whitefield as Wesley's friend me. They got along sometimes, they didn't some other times. And Wesley was particularly concerned with things that were orderly and decent, that was very important to him. And so Whitefield's outdoor preaching with the chaos that it brought, just in the sense of having large crowds, he didn't like it. He felt like it wasn't right, but he couldn't deny the impact that Whitefield was having. And so finally, Wesley writes in his diary, he submits to becoming more vile and preaching outside. And so Wesley then also launches on a series of preaching tours, both through England and the United States. They both preach in the United States several times. And they really popularize this useful thing of preaching outside, right? There's some practical necessities about who all can come hear you, the audience that you can reach. So if Whitefield is the preacher of the First Great Awakening, the theologian of the First Great Awakening is Jonathan Edwards, who lived from 1703 to 1758, was a pastor in Northampton, Massachusetts. And Edwards was a pastor, but he wrote and thought a lot. And as these revivals were happening, Edwards really thought a lot about what was going on. So one of his first writings that he has on this, the faithful narrative of the surprising works of God, in 1737, which was an account, very, very detailed account, of the born-again experiences of people in this congregation who had been born again in a revival a few years before. And this work became one of the classics of revivalist literature, as it gave people a sign of hope that the Spirit of God was moving in the world and moving in dynamic ways. 1741, we get Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, and that becomes a classic of American literature. And then, but for what our purposes, what I really want to talk about is another sermon he gives in 1741 called The Distinguishing Marks of the Work of the Spirit. And then 1746, A Treatise Concerning Religious Affections. And so the first of these, The Distinguishing Marks of the Work of God, is an exploration of what makes a true revival versus a false revival. And then Religious Affections explores how to know when you've had a truly born-again experience. Because while these revivals are bringing people to God, or bringing people to these moments of conversion and these direct encounters with God, They're bringing with them some unintended consequences. There's a lot of controversy around revivals and whether or not they're good, because they, as people become born again and have this increased vigor of their faith, one of the things that that causes them to do is to question the spiritual community around them, namely their church and their pastors, and to question if that spiritual community itself has been born again and if that community is as dedicated to God as it should be. Gilbert Tennent, who's a Presbyterian minister, publishes The Danger of an Unconverted Ministry in 1740, in which he basically says, just because your pastor went to seminary doesn't mean they've been born again, and you should find a pastor who has been born again. And what that does is it starts to shift spiritual power and who is at the center of spiritual life to the individual. Then now it's on the individual to judge and assess if they are at the right church, if they're in the right community. And this is a big shift from what we've traditionally seen of parish-based congregation attendance, where you go to the church that's the one in your neighborhood. And now we're shifting sort of spiritual power in a way from the default authority of pastors into the individual. And then also, while being born again can give one tremendous assurance about their salvation, it can also cause a lot of anxiety about the question about, have I really been born again? Is that really the moment? And so Edwards is responding to all of these concerns and these consequences that are happening as these revivals sweep through the United States. And so when we get to the 1770s, the greatest American experiment begins, the American Revolution. And I want to take a minute to talk about how religion and the initial founding and struggles of the early republic play together. So the founders decide to create a republican government in the United States. This is not republican as in the Republican Party, but republican as in style of government. And this style of government is particularly appealing because it values and emphasizes liberty. A lot of the discussion about justification for the revolution is around resisting tyranny. And so this new government, this new republic, is very focused on valuing and preserving liberty. And a part of that is balancing power, right? How do we have checks and balances to keep one group from having too much power and then sliding into tyranny? And so that comes with it a high degree of self-rule, of bringing power down levels. So we start to see a rise of local government, state government, things like that. But this, in order for this republic to succeed, it needs virtue. It needs people who are willing to put aside their particular self-interest for the betterment of all. Dr. Byrd and Hedman Boimler say, in a republic, people govern themselves through elected representatives. So a republic is only as good as its citizens. Good government depends on virtuous citizens who sacrifice themselves for the greater good, just as it depended on virtuous leadership who would do what was best for all the people without using political influences to fill their own pockets. In short, good government depended on virtue, a word that meant moral character and self-sacrificial courage. This is one reason why so many colonists believed that Christianity supports patriotism, because Christianity supported virtue and self-sacrificial love. So this connection is not just something that political scientists and historians have made after the fact. This was something that the founders were very aware of themselves. This is a letter from John Adams to one of his cousins in 1776, and he says, "Statesmen, my dear sir, may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. The only foundation of a free constitution is pure virtue." And so we see that this is a question that's front of mind for the founders as they're going about establishing this new republic. So the question for them to work out then is, how do these things relate to each other? How do politics, virtue, and religion come together? And there's a pretty unanimous consensus that religion is good for morality, that is the way, or good for virtue, that's how we teach it, it's how we encourage it, it's how we enforce it. But there's also a lot of concern around directly connecting religion and government. and politics. And again, this goes back to this idea of tyranny. By this point in the United States, there's a number of groups that have been called dissenter groups, so groups that are not Anglican, essentially, in this context. And so we've been seeing a rise of Methodists and Baptists, and also Puritans and Congregationalists, who want to be able to practice Christianity in the way that they want, and as separate from an official church. And so those groups are particularly concerned with the idea of religious liberty and that freedom of expression. And so as the early Republic wrestles with this, Virginia gives us a great example of how this debate plays out. The Anglican Church had been established as a state-sponsored church in Virginia in 1606. And this was actually a fairly common thing in most of the American colonies, that the state, some of your tax dollars, went to support one particular denomination. And so as time went on, and as we got to the American Revolution, attendance in the Anglican Church started to dip. And certainly after the American Revolution, being attached to the official church in England was less than appealing. And not only did your tax dollars go to support the Anglican Church, but if you weren't Anglican, you were subject to a number of sanctions and restrictions from what type of public office you could participate in. But you can imagine in this liberty-focused, freedom-loving republic, they don't like that so much anymore, and so they're looking to change it. And so in the 1780s, there's a bill put forward that says, essentially, we still need to support churches. Again, that's important for ensuring that we have a virtuous citizenship, and a virtuous citizenship is what will enable us to have a good, strong, lasting republic. But you can choose where your tax dollars go. So if you don't want your tax dollars to go support the Anglican Church, that's fine. You can pick another church that they can go to. And we'll remove all the sanctions for not participating in any of those churches. So you don't have to go to church, but your tax dollars will help fund one. And that's appealing to a lot of folks. Jefferson and Madison, however, are concerned. And they're concerned that establishing that direct link between Christianity and government will become a slippery slope for introducing a specific denomination. So instead, they put forward a bill for establishing religious freedom, which ultimately gets passed in the Virginia legislature in 1786. And that removes all state funding for the church and removes any requirement, religious requirements for participating in public office. And this bill becomes the foundation for the First Amendment and Bill of Rights. And that amendment, that addition to in the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, in turn becomes critically important to getting the Constitution passed. There were a number of folks who were concerned with the way that the Constitution itself was written, that it didn't sufficiently cover religious liberty. So we have a sort of a direct through line here from this bill in the Virginia legislature through ultimately the Bill of Rights and the ratification of the Constitution. And so that is then critically important, because now we no longer have state-sponsored churches, and that's going to change the way that the congregations and churches relate. So finally, we've made it to the 19th century. I thought you were coming for this, and so we spent most of our time in the late 1700s. But there's some other things about this early republic that I think are good for us to talk about. So there is, with the rise of this republic and this rejection of the monarchy, comes a rejection of nobility and of gentry. And anything that sort of feels like an elite generational wealth class having the authority. And instead, what we come to is the rise of the common man, that common sense is where truth is, that truth is self-evident, that the best arbiters or the best people to discern what is true is actually the common person. So we see the rise of this idea of the common man, the self-made man. There's a big emphasis on work in this period, that it is good to work. But increasingly, we see this idea of where authority rests coming down to the everyday person, even specifically to the individual. We're seeing a democratization of religion. Again, as we remove state sponsorship of churches, as we introduce and legislate more religious freedom, there's more choice to choose from. The First Great Awakening told us that we can choose where we go to church, and we are the spiritual judges of our own lives. And then also, It's important not to understate how uncertain this time is. The early Republic is often referred to the American experiment. I just referred to it that way a few slides ago. And it's really true that the nation feels like it's doing something radically new. So what is that going to look like? How is that going to work out? So there's times of tremendous, tremendous change. And into that change, we get the Second Great Awakening. Second Great Awakening is actually the one that gave the First Great Awakening its name. First Great Awakening didn't identify itself that way, but the leaders of the Second Great Awakening very much looked back to the first and saw what they were doing as a continuation of that revival and that reform. And so there's three manifestations of the Second Great Awakening that I want to talk about. The first is camp meetings, which were particularly popular in Kentucky and Tennessee. The most famous of these was the Cane Ridge Revival from August 6th to 12th in 1801. It starts off as a gathering of Scots Presbyterians for a communion service. And they gathered infrequently, so when they did, it was a multi-day event with preaching designed to make sure that when you came to the communion table, you came with a free soul. So if you needed to reconcile with anyone, if you needed to repent of anything, there were several days before the actual communion service to make sure that you did that. Well, something happened, and it's hard to pin down what exactly it was, but this group of Scots Presbyterians grew and grew and grew. It's hard to estimate it, so scholars give somewhere between 10,000 and 25,000 people who showed up in Cambridge. To put that in perspective, the largest town in Kentucky had less than 2,000 people in it. So there's tremendous flocking to Cane Ridge, and it turns into somewhat unplanned revival with preaching and singing 24/7. But one of the things that's particularly unique about Cane Ridge is there's a lot of charismatic movements of the spirit. So we see accounts of people twirling, people shrieking, people falling down, just counts of people barking like dogs. So this is where we start to see these kind of erratic, powerful, charismatic movements of the spirit. And Cambridge certainly isn't the only camp meeting. It's not the first, but it is by far the most famous and the most popular. And it sets this precedent for this style of outdoor preaching, of gathering, and becomes heavily adopted by the Methodists. Up in New England, there's a revival in Yale led by Timothy Dwight, who happens to be the grandson of Jonathan Edwards. And he had been the president of Yale for a while and started preaching a sermon series in 1802 because he felt like the students at Yale had turned away from the faith and needed to be brought back. And there was a revival that swept through, and about a third of the students at Yale had born-again conversion experiences. What's really important for our purposes about this revival is the impacts that came from it. So two of the students who were there during this revival, one was Lyman Beecher, who becomes a very important figure in American Christianity in this time. And he is a minister, but also sees a very strong connection between being born again, being called to this new life in Christ, and social reform. He has a number of children, I think it's 13, and his children are also heavily involved in social reform, and you may recognize his most famous daughter, who is Harriet Beecher Stowe. And so, in addition to Beecher, we also have Nathaniel William Taylor, who is a Calvinist, but he revisits the Calvinist doctrine of predestination and original sin, and in some ways updates it for this new freedom-loving republic. And so he does away with the idea of original sin and says that sin is a choice, and so we can choose whether or not to sin. And this is known as the New Haven theology, and causes a lot of controversy within the Calvinist community in the United States. He gets accused of Pelagianism, which is essentially, if you take it to its logical conclusion, the idea that we can save ourselves. And we'll talk about more about him next week, but this split within the Calvinists within the United States ends up having a lasting impact. And then finally, our third group is the Burned Over District in upstate New York and Vermont. And this is a place which, for reasons that historians haven't quite been able to figure out, experiences a series of revivals again and again and again over a 30-year span of time. So it's been burned over because the fires of revival have flown through so many times. But out of this area is come a number of groups who we're going to spend a lot of time talking about next week. So this is where we get the Oneidans and the Mormons and the Seventh-day Adventists starting. The Shakers enter the United States, and their initial communities are in this area before they spread through the rest of the United States. And so there is something about this place where they just experience this renewal and reform time and time again. And so I do want to highlight one particular person, and he's particularly important for the revivals in the burned over district, but also leaves a legacy that will shape Christian discourse in the United States. And that's Charles Finney, who lived from 1792 to 1875. And Finney was a lawyer who has a conversion experience and decides to become a preacher. Much like Whitfield, he is known for his dynamic preaching, his casual language, and he becomes the revivalist of the Second Great Awakening and preaches something like 100 sermons between December and March in New York City 1 year. And again, just prolific preacher. But what he does, he takes a different view of revival than the First Great Awakening. In the First Great Awakening, revivals were seen as miracles, that these were spontaneous movements of God that created these revival and reform moments. And Finney says, they're not quite that miraculous. They're still the work of God, but we can sow the seeds of revival and reform. And so he institutes what he calls new measures and codifies them and popularizes them. He is certainly, most of these new measures are not actually new, but he brings them together. So the biggest ones of these new measures are he introduces what he calls the anxious bench, which is, he borrows from the Methodists, which is a bench or a pew up in the front of the congregation for anyone who is feeling troubled in their spirit about their salvation or something else. They can come up and sit on the anxious bench for additional prayer. That's the predecessor of the modern altar call. He also allows women to pray in mixed company. And this is seen as a hugely controversial thing at the time. Women have been preaching and exhorting, particularly in revivals and as part of revivals, but he legitimizes that and helps set the stage for the increasing inclusion of women in the mixed communal life of the congregation. And then finally, he also helps to normalize this use of regular everyday